All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Conditions of Maintenance and Certification Task Force. Hard to believe this is now our fourth call in a week, so we are making good progress here. We'll start with a brief roll call. Denise Webb.
Present.
Raj, I believe, is going to be absent. Carolyn Peterson.
Present.
Ken is absent as well. Sasha Termoff?
Here.
Leslie Linnert?
Here.
John Travis?
Here.
Great. We are all set to go. I will turn it over to Kate from ONC, and then before we're diving into our next discussion items around updates to the 2015 certification.
Great.
All
thanks,
right.
Lauren. Oh, go ahead, Denise.
No, I was just going to say, Kate, you're going to do the brief review of our charge, and then we can jump into our discussion.
Sure. And just to follow up, yesterday we covered the attestations and API. We have a couple of follow-up items on the ONC side that we will get back to you all with. And then I just wanted to highlight, there will be an API, like a specific API presentation that Steve Posnack will be giving on Tuesday, March 13th at 2 p.m. And in order to register, you can go to, it's on the ONC website on the NPRM landing page. So a quick review of the charge for the task force. This task force will provide recommendations on API, real-world testing, and attestations, conditions, and maintenance of certification requirements, updates to the 2015 edition certification criteria, including API, electronic health information export, e-prescribing, clinical quality measures export, and two privacy and security-related attestation criteria. Also look at the modifications to the ONC Health IT certification program and any deregulatory actions related to certification criteria and program requirements. Turn it back to you, Denise.
All right. So I thought to go through, if we'll go to the next slide, we're going to go through these remaining updates to the 2015 edition certification criteria. And
this slide is just like an overview. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, do you want to go over this slide for us, Kate? And then maybe what we could do is go pull up the regulatory text and step through it, because that might be conducive for this discussion today. And then we can reference the preamble, which the preamble for this today is on pages, hold on a second, so I can get everybody in the same place. It's pages 78 through 107.
I think, correct.
And
right?
Denise, we have the OneNote, or the OneNote, the Google Doc now too, right? So we could take notes in it.
Yeah, that's what I was suggesting, if we could share the Google Doc. Are we able to do that, Kate?
Yes, I can share my screen.
Okay.
So do you want me to go ahead and walk through some of these slides? I'll just explain.
Yeah, if you don't mind, and then that'll launch us in to cover these items. I would highlight the ones that we're going to talk about today.
Okay. So this slide here is proposed changes to the 2015 edition certification criteria, and this includes more than the few items we're going to discuss today. It goes over the base EHR definition criteria under the removed criteria, other criteria, and we will get into this discussion, more of these discussions, when we talk about the deregulatory actions and proposals that ONC made to remove certain criteria. And then the blue box here is the updated criteria. So, for instance, we'll talk about e-prescribing today and API. And then if you look to the right of that, there's the revised criteria, CQMs we will discuss today, and then new criteria. The first two are the two privacy and security attestation criteria that we will discuss. And then the third one is consent management for application programming interfaces. Okay, the
now
next
are
line.
Are we covering, just to, out of curiosity, I know we have to talk about the two new security criteria, but I didn't know, are we covering consent management for APIs?
So we included that.
Did we already cover that?
That's more included in the discussion for the data segmentation for privacy, which I believe another task force is covering, but I can double check on that.
Yeah, I didn't think that one was on our list. And then the real big one today is around the data export changes.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, should we go through the slides, or do you want to just jump into the reg text and start the discussion?
I think just so we can make a good use of our time and get through what we have to discuss, because I think we're probably going to have a lot of discussion on the data export with our representatives from the vendor community. So
that's a good guess.
I agree.
So if no one objects, why don't we start walking through? And I think we're starting with data export. Is that correct? I remember looking at that document last night.
Very basic. You know what page of the display copy you're starting on? I could certainly find it. I have it open, but just
88.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you all see the?
Yes.
You can see the screen?
Yeah. All right. So this this update to the regulatory text would replace the existing data export regulation text, and this is going to focus on two use cases: data export for a single patient, and that would be all of the patient's EHI. We had quite a hearty discussion this morning on information blocking and the definition of EHI. And then the second use case is around exporting all of the EHI to support a customer moving from one product to another product. So if we start here with the single patient electronic health information export, why don't we discuss A, B, and C here? My computer's going wacko here. So why don't we discuss the first use case around single patient electronic information export? And any comments, recommendations, or major concerns with this requirement? Go ahead, Sasha.
Sure. So this is Sasha. I've given extensive thought to this proposal and thinking with colleagues here about how to implement getting a patient all of their exported data. And I think even though they don't necessarily tie to the regulatory text, there's several buckets I'd like us to consider kind of thinking about. One, and this is, I guess, one where I just defer to the clinicians, but it seems to me that this criterion sort of implies that everyone has implemented open notes. Notes would certainly be within the export format, and so that would, I guess, from implications perspective, any of the patient's historical notes would certainly be part of the content that was exported. And so I think that kind of is one thing that clinicians would want to think about. It leads to a secondary sort of concern, which is partly about notes, but partly about other content, which is that as a health system implements this export, how would they ensure that they weren't accidentally exporting electronically something that was not allowed by their state law to be released electronically? And so I think there's a question of how this export of all the data, which is much broader than other types of criteria we might have talked about in the standards for filtering those appropriately, would be there, and then how that sort of jives with compliance with other regulations and legislation. I think there's some particular categories of data that will get tricky there. I can give a list, but I don't know if we want to sort of dig into those first.
Yeah, and I've got a similar point, Sasha, but it's kind of part philosophical and it's part pragmatic. And I kind of was holding this for the Bolt case, the second use case, but it really applies to both because they both have the same breadth. So if I'm not mistaken, basically the concept is that the export needs to provide for the ability to produce an electronic output of all the data that is held within the certified EHR module that is presented for certification. So there's a terrific
John, is
definition.
It limited to the certified EHR module, or is it all data in the system that has a component presented?
That's probably a good point of conversation. So the way I understand this, there's really, it is bounded to the certified system, I think, because that's what brings about the requirement, versus the information blocking provisions that do extend everything. So there's a difference, I think, between the export criteria that's, I think, is practically limited to data held by CERT, which I want to get into a little bit, and the information blocking provision extends to everything certified or non-certified that the vendor who is seeking certification or holds certification offers to market. So I think there is a difference there, and it's an important one because you have to produce the semantic reference information about what export requires. It seems grayer when you get to information blocking. I agree in some ways there's not a lot of tangible difference if you are approached to enable an export or to enable an electronic disclosure or an extraction, whatever you want to call it, when you get to the information blocking rules. But honing in on the data export, I'm not sure it extends to everything you do. I think it extends to all data types held by the certified EHR technology that you have presented for certification as a practical matter. I realize this is intended to be more of an attestation. It's not very testable as it is, other than by that.
So,
and it speaks to, being able to meet a demand to produce an export, but you actually have to produce the export inclusive of the reference map or whatever supports the semantic understanding of what the data is. But I do think there is a boundary on it. Now, the existential question in here is, they speak of it's not limited to the U.S. CDI. It is all data held by CERT. So the important question to me here is if that's correct, and that's probably worth finding out, but if it's correct, then there is a burden on the vendor to practically define that. So, for example...
So, John, can I just,
yeah.
Can I just interrupt for a minute?
Sure.
There is a definition of EHI, and it refers to the EHI that's held in the certified
Correct. But yeah, I understand.
I pasted it into the comment too, just for reference, if that's helpful, or I could put it into the blue below if that's useful.
Here's my point about that remark. It doesn't suddenly enable the presence of EHI that's not present. So you use the definition of EHI to inform what information is held by CERT. But here's the problem I have, two problems. One is there still is a practical definition of what is held by CERT. So integration doesn't mean inclusion. And I think, for both Epic and Cerner, we're integrated models. We have revenue cycle. We have supply chain. We have ancillary systems that are not part of CERT. And this is why this matters, because if I accept it at face value to apply to everything in a physical sense held in an integrated data model, and I draw no distinction about what is within the scope of CERT and what is not, then Sasha, you're absolutely right. There's no distinction. It's everything. But that is a mighty distinction compared to the statement that it's held by CERT, because revenue cycle, by and large, is not part of CERT. Many ancillary systems are not part of CERT. Supply chain is not part of CERT ad nauseum. So this matters.
It definitely matters. It's hugely important.
Yeah.
I guess I was worried because, and I agree with you that the distinction is critical, but I was worried where they say the health IT's entire database, including but not limited to clinical, administrative, and claims billing data, there's no implication that claims or billing data would ever be part of CERT. So the preamble language was making me think they intended a broader scope.
I agree. On my first reading, that was my reaction, but it needs to be very cleared up.
I think we're getting into, on the two use cases, there's the one for the patient. I don't believe you're going to give an export of the entire database to the patient.
The scope is for both of the use cases, and then it would just be limited to data about the patient for the patient use case. But they say it would cover the whole database in terms,
in theory.
I read it as saying if you had claims about the patient, you should export those too.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think they're drawing a distinction of scope based on the use case.
Okay, so what I hear you both saying, that sounds like a concern that we should make a note on. And while I can see this, I don't have a way to put notes in here, so hopefully, Kate, you're capturing these notes. Or someone is.
I can add that.
I believe that. So one of the major concerns here is the scope of this export. Is it data that is collected and retained, used in the certified portions of the product, or is it really intended all data, whether the product's certified or not, and does that fit within the authority of the certification program?
That's essentially it. And if there is a practical, or at least let's say a conceptual definition of the boundaries of CERT, I have no dispute that it's all data held within that boundary, that CHI. My issue is, does it extend, which by contrast, the information blocking provision does, but it's a big difference. Does it reach non-certified EHR technology? And I want to use the phrase, and I suggest it to be used, integration does not mean inclusion, if that's true. But that does suggest there's a burden on the vendor to offer a practical statement of how they identify the boundaries of what's held in CERT. And I understand the data mart, the point that Sasha was raising, I had to think about five times about that, but the way I realized it is, if there's a capability within the scope of the certified product that depends on utilization of kind of an auxiliary table space or data mart, that's part of it as well. So for example, in our architecture, our mainline product for our clinical EHR is most of what we do, but we do have measurement capabilities that actually will be in a distinct database, but within scope of the same EHR module. So when we present it, both of those are in play, but that doesn't mean suddenly our revenue cycle's in play and our supply chain's in play. Those are integrated into those systems, but they are distinct tables, distinct data types, and they can be parsed out from what we would enable for export here. So that's the key practical difference that we need to have clarity about.
Or they may not be integrated at all, because
the integration doesn't matter. My reaction probably is a bias towards being integrated, that could be what's good for the goose is not good for the gander. Just by virtue of integration doesn't mean suddenly I'm in a different boat than somebody who's not. where clearly there's a physical distinction, and it's easy to say, well, that over there is not integrated and it's not certified, so I don't worry about it. I don't want to be punished for the fact that it is integrated, but it's not cert. That doesn't make any sense. And I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that's why the distinction matters. And I think if somebody wants to go to the place of thinking, well, it's anything that's integrated with your cert, no, it's not cert. So that makes a big difference to the way I would scope my response to this to go to test for it.
Yeah, well, I was just going to comment because, you know, the health system I came from happened to be on your product, but its revenue cycle, the revenue cycle was totally separate. So
yeah.
It was a different product.
And it
yet
certainly
it's,
can
yet
be.
Yet it's interface. So there's a lot
yeah.
of health systems that use a different revenue cycle product. So then that would have billing and claims type information for a patient. So, all right. So I don't know if we need to beat a dead horse here. I think the point's well made that there needs to be some clarification or some consideration about this issue.
Do we need to comment about the other provisions with both implications in mind? I mean, I guess it's pretty different if it's cert or if it's the whole system.
I think we certainly can ask for clarity, and if there's things to play out, assuming either, that's fair game, certainly.
Okay.
So what I'm hearing too, though, is if there's clarity provided in the final rule that this is here's what the boundaries are, and it's further defined.
Hopefully, not too much snow overnight.
We are having bleed over from, or somebody needs to mute their phone.
Yeah, I don't know where that's.
So the function of exporting the data could still take
you, but I'll see
satisfy.
Jeff, the other Jeff.
Could still satisfy whatever the definition is of the boundaries are.
So other Jeff will be there.
If we could have everyone mute their lines, please. If not, we'll have the operator mute for us. Sorry, Denise. Go ahead.
All right. So, Sasha, are you suggesting that we need to? I'm sorry, I got distracted on what comment you wanted to make or additional.
Yeah, so I guess my question is, we do need clarity about if the scope is cert or if the scope is all integrated products for the reasons that John describes. I'm wondering, as we talk about the feasibility and challenges of some of the other components of this, should we be assuming it's one way or the other, or comment on it with respect to both?
Well, what would we... considering the information blocking portion of the rule, would we want to recommend that this export function only was for EHI that is collected and retained by the certified technology? I don't think that's their intent, to tell you the truth. It would be in conflict with the information blocking.
Well, not necessarily.
So what's the purpose?
So personally, I would favor that constraint on certified EHR technology and the data export criterion. And I think the reason I say that is that I accept it as non-trivial to provide the semantic reference information about the what is being exported that needs to be computable. And here's why I go there. The information blocking provision, setting aside, you know, whether or not it's properly scoped or not, it pulls in, quite simply, everything that you have as an application or a product. And there's, and you know, at least in our thoughts about it for what we'll comment as an organization, I think there's some things we'll look to raise there that are pragmatic problems with that assumption. But we do understand its scope is proposed, but it reaches legacy systems, it reaches systems that you might have deprecated, it reaches systems that may be old versions of currently commercially offered products. There's a lot of things that are challenging about taking it at face value if you're going to hold it up to the data export criteria. And while they don't propose a standard, which is probably wise given the form of what the data would be in a lot of those older systems, to apply the requirement for semantic interoperability or, you know, a data map, whatever, to everything that's in an inventory of what a HIT vendor may have, could be very challenging in any useful way, because there is basically the requirement that it's computable. Well, whether I'm embarrassed or not to say it, we still have some products that are our original generation that are COBOL fixed file formats that I'm not sure about the computable part of that on the part of a recipient unless they've got an ability to interact with some pretty old computing technology. So
did you read that it had to be computable for the patient extract?
For the bulk one.
Yeah, I did, Denise. Well, I think the idea is a patient app might be able to parse it.
Yeah, I think it's more than that. I think that a patient should be able to take their records on a whatever portable electronic drive and essentially upload them to an EHR. I think that's what they're saying, is that the patient is the vehicle of interoperability.
Yeah, I agree, but
Les?
I think...
Les, is that you speaking?
That's Les, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I just didn't recognize your voice. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, well, that would probably be the first time you heard it. Anyway.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I think the export criteria is written substantially with contemporary systems in mind that have more evolved capabilities. Let me just put it that way. And it is a significant reach. Now, they do talk about, I do believe, in the export section, whether or not it should have the same breadth of applicability as does the information blocking provision. So they do raise the question, but I think that speaks of they do understand there's a difference in what they propose and the information blocking scope. So I think to me the right answer is, it's all EHI held by CERT for purposes of export, and it applies to both use cases, and it does require a processable output that has the semantic reference information that accompanies the data. I don't have any, you know, that is what it is, but that does not extend to everything that you do. I think there's a large open or pregnant pause relative to the broader requirement of information blocking that puts the task to the vendor and the requester of the data to work out how the data will be provided without getting into saying how it will be provided. And it doesn't get into speaking to the semantic reference information requirement that data export does, unless I missed something. So there's difference.
Right. Well, I think, okay, so I think we have a good sense of what the concern is here. And can capture that in a recommendation. There was a couple things that Sasha said that I would like to respond to on some thoughts around what is in the export versus the volume, the breadth of the export. But you mentioned open notes, Sasha.
Yeah.
So notes. And I think OCR and others have been pretty clear about this, and patient advocates, that the patient, the notes in a patient's medical record are that those belong to the patient. And I know some health systems, the providers, have been forthcoming and provided through the Open Notes initiative, provided notes to patients, and others refuse to provide their notes to patients because they don't have good hygiene in the terms of how they might write their notes, and they might put things in their notes that offend patients. So, you know, on Open Notes, I don't know what the rest of the group thinks. As far as the notes in a patient's record, unless we're talking about psychiatric notes, and actually there are, you're correct about state laws being different in every state concerning mental health treatment, and that's an issue, and we should probably highlight that, that you can't necessarily export everything that a patient asks for. We do have to reflect on what the laws of the state are. So how does that vendor handle that? That's probably the more salient point.
Yeah, my thinking, Denise, and I guess this is like just speculation to help folks have context. I think that my approach as a vendor would be to provide a query that could be used for this export that could be edited by a health system for several reasons. One would be if they need to restrict certain types of communication, like psychiatric notes, to be filtered out. Another reason to edit would be if they have any usage restrictions on data that's stored. This maybe gets somewhat back to the debate John and I were having about what's in CERT or if it's all data. But sometimes people will import data, like a claim set from a payer that has a redisclosure usage restriction. And so if there's other data sets that would have to be filtered out, if they live in a state where a certain piece of information, like a sensitive test result, is not allowed to be released electronically, that they could edit it to filter that out. If there's a teenage privacy type of restriction where, oh, the patient could see the teenage, you know, pregnancy test result, but the parents can't, but only in certain ages or certain states, that the health system would have to accommodate those types of edits as well. But then I guess the question is, regardless of who's doing the edits, whether it's the developer providing standard tools or configuration methods or the health system trying to do that, is it practical to effectively restrict this broad of an export in compliance with what might be 50 permutations of state law? I think that's a reasonable question for us to ask.
I think that I agree.
Well, you mean to ask, you mean in terms of making a recommendation that there needs to be further elaboration?
I think the challenging part, yes, I guess, I think that the way it is currently proposed, health systems will be at high risk of either restricting what they release too much, right? And then they are at risk of health of information blocking. If they said, I don't know if this PDF that I have in the system is a scanned psychiatric note from another system or contains a sensitive test result or not, so I'm not going to release it, then they're at risk of information blocking because they didn't provide enough information to the patient in the preferred format. But if they don't restrict and they say, I don't, you know, have discrete metadata about what's in this PDF, it might be a test result that the patient wants, I'll release it electronically as part of this export. Then they're at risk of being found in noncompliance with a state law that says you can't release that type of test result electronically.
Yeah, and there's many use cases like that, Sasha, and one seems to have come up in spades for me in my week here is the one where the patients, things that would fall under the privacy exception for information blocking that have to do with patient requests to withhold information from their health plan. So if the purpose of the export was to provide information to fulfill a payer request and they wanted to make use of it, they'd have to understand where those restrictions exist. And there's just a lot of those types of cases. So the practical use of this out of the box as is, unless it's kind of an approach that Sasha mentions, is going to be highly problematic to produce with fidelity what is being asked for, just as a matter of selection criteria, never mind scope of content.
So this is Carolyn.
Carolyn, go ahead.
It sounds like there's quite a lot of good points and important things to take into consideration as we frame this comment. One thing I think that we shouldn't ignore is the context in which patient requests for information and expectations of information release. It's true that some health systems are not wanting to provide information and notes because of hygiene or whatever other issues, but the environment is such that I think the trend is going to be forward for more of that to be going on and for patients to be expecting that more. You know, it's not an environment in which that will be happening less and less. So maybe this is not such a consideration. Even with the later adopters, patient expectations of getting information are going forward, and that's something that ONC needs to be thinking about as they clarify and pull these things together.
Carolyn, I think one thing that would be helpful to that effect would be, and a parallel effort perhaps, on harmonizing state restrictions and laws. It's actually, I think if patients saw what their state policies were on restriction of electronic communication of certain things, they would feel, as you described, that the policy is not consistent with what they would demand as patients and as consumers. But I think that it is a tough spot to try to provide what patients are looking for, which might be all the data right away, and be at risk of really other regulatory or legislative obligations as a health system.
And certainly there needs to be consideration given to all of those types of jeopardies that health systems can be in and providers can be in and the challenges for vendors. But, you know, even if consumers understood that there were very complex regulations across 50 states that made the technology hard to do the things that are required under law, it seems unlikely to me that consumers as a population would throw up their hands and say, oh, well, gosh, you know, it's so hard, we just won't ask for our data anymore. I just don't think that's a realistic. I think
we should go the other direction and say that if consumer demand is for the data, then we need to deal with the other policies like the state laws that make that challenging, right? Exporting all the data is much easier from a technical perspective than attempting to know what might be in this PDF and whether releasing it electronically is in violation of state law, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think, and I'll just say just from my experience in my last role, all releases of information were handled through the health information office because of things that you've brought up, Sasha, like state laws.
Yeah,
and they do release an entire electronic record because I just moved from one health system to another, and I asked for my entire record, and it's in PDF, and it does say even here on page 94, you know, no matter the electronic format, PDFs are included. You know, the function of those HIM folks is to review the information before it's released to the patient, so that they know they're in compliance with the law. So I think it needs to be acknowledged in the rule that this export has to be designed in a way, or processes have to be in place that are the releaser of the information is accountable to ensure that the information that's released is allowed to be released. So
I don't think
we're going to solve this. And I know the federal government is not going to get into the business of the state's laws. While we'd like to have them all harmonized, that's a state-by-state issue.
I do think, Denise, I agree that I think manual review is the process by which health information management departments handle this today. And I think that that could be an answer to the how do I release enough but not too much question a health system will face, but it doesn't jive with some of ONC's other descriptions of this functionality, like the expectation that the export would be available in near real time, or I guess like that to me says that they're not picturing a step of, and then it's queued up for someone in the health information management department to read over it and make sure it's not accidentally releasing something electronically that state law prohibits.
Yeah, but it doesn't say near real time even. It just says timely does not mean real time. But if you're going to take 3 weeks to give your patient their data, well, that's not timely. I think, you know, if a patient makes a request for their data and they can get it within 72 hours, you know, that's probably reasonable because of these manual things that are going to have to occur, because you're absolutely correct about the state laws and the filtering. You as a vendor can't just give an export function and say, well, here you go, and just let the patient go into the portal and download everything, because then your customer is going to have a problem because they're probably going to be violating some state laws.
Yeah. Well, I think that would make sense. That would also help with some other data categories that I was thinking about with respect to the export, like if you have any shared data, group therapy notes that might be shared, linked mother and baby documentation, anything where there's sort of shared information. I was thinking, like, well, how do you handle that with an export, right? That's going to be tough.
Right.
I was also thinking about in-progress stuff. So, like, if someone is halfway through a note when the patient says, give me my export, do you give the half-finished note? Do you have a time window to say, like, that wasn't done? You know, how do you finish, like, if someone's midway through their admission and wants their stuff, but nurses might be like halfway through an assessment, people might be halfway through a procedure note. All of those types of questions.
Well, I don't think those are considered part of the medical record until they're assigned.
Is this limited to the medical record? I guess I read electronic health information as broader than the medical record.
Well, there's another thing to clarify, is this the something that is official and signed?
Do we need to focus on this idea of distinctions of the types of data in the medical record between administrative, clinical, and research, that those three categories are very distinct, that they all could be in electronic health information systems, but that the provenance of those is very different. Was the intention here to include all the administrative data that might be relevant to the patient, like the nurse who was on the patient's shift? Or
yes, I mean, it says less on page 94, for both use cases supported by this criterion, EHR export encompasses all the EHI that the health IT system produces and electronically manages for a patient or group of patients. This includes, this applies to the health IT's entire database, including but not limited to clinical, administrative, and claims billing data. And this is what launched this concern that John and Sasha had to begin with, is that goes beyond CERT, because there a number of these data types are not generated or by a certified product that's governed
by
this.
Yes, they asked particular questions about that also. So, for example, there's a whole discussion of the value of diagnostic images for a patient's export. But ONC acknowledges that those are typically stored in a PACS system, not in an electronic health record, and would the health record be able to export it? And I guess, you know, maybe this seems like a straightforward answer, but I think the health record can only export data that's in the health record.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good point. I think that this idea, I mean, I'm a little puzzled as to the rationale for needing to export the administrative data.
Administrative data can include, you know, claims, billing. An EHI is defined to include payment. Prior, current, and future expected. So what the kind of conundrum we're in here right now with this regulation text is that it refers to certified technology and what the technology, the EHR would have to be certified to provide this export function, but the export function seems to more broadly address the Cures Act in terms of providing all the EHR to the patient or to the health provider who wants to move to a different product, and that extends beyond the product that's being certified. So I think that's really kind of describing what the issue is here.
Yes.
All right. So and that would capture the issue about images, right, Sasha? Because
I have them separately written down in the notes, but I think they are very interrelated.
Okay.
If we limit to certified EHR technology, that probably solves the images problem also, but I have two proposals actually. If Kate scrolls down to the text box, I tried to organize our notes to say first, what were we proposed? Well, we had a question for clarity, we had two proposals, and then I have a whole bunch of discussion notes just so that we remember what we talked about. So there's the question,
okay,
there's the two proposals I documented, and then the discussion notes start there and go on to the next page.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yep.
So they do ask on page 96, let's see here, I want to make sure I got all the places where they were seeking comment. They did ask, and I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on this, on who could ask for the patient's data and should that be limited. Carolyn, do you have any thoughts on that? This is on page 92 in the preamble. We see comment on whether this portion of the criterion should be made more prescriptive. This is where they're saying that the healthcare professional or his or her office staff or a software program or service could interact directly with the certified health IT to provide, you know, and be the user to do this export on behalf of the patient. And they're seeking comment on whether this portion of the criterion should be made more prescriptive to only allow the patient and his or her authorized representative to be the requester of their EHI.
Well, I think if you do make it more prescriptive, more restrictive in that sense, you can reduce the potential for fraud and for identity. I don't know that identity theft is the term, but for getting some information about someone out of a place where they think it's secure for purposes that the patient doesn't support. At the same time, I suspect some providers would be concerned because they would find it inconvenient to have to actually contact the patient and get permission. I mean, normally we all sign those forms when you go in for a visit, but if someone has some kind of an emergency situation or perhaps there is a custody issue with a child, for example, and the dots are not being connected in terms of who can authorize release of information or request certain things. I think in general it works best for patients in the average case to be able to make those requests and decisions themselves. But, you know, the world is not made up of standard cases.
Well, I don't think this precludes other releases of information through other release processes. I think, isn't this just specifically referring to the EHR export of a patient's entire record at the patient's request?
Yeah, I sort of read this language, this question, as should a patient be able to go into something like a patient portal and say, give me my export with a button, or should the patient be able to ask their doctor or someone in medical records at the clinic, like, hey, please provide me my export, or both?
Yeah, well, that's a good point, because I don't know if this has ever happened to any of you, but I've been in an office visit, and I said, oh, could you print that off for me? And I've been told, no, you have to go request it and fill out a form where the provider wasn't able to do it on my behalf. So if that's what they're referring to here, then I think providers should be able to do it on behalf of the patient.
Yeah, I mean, it's a conundrum. I think certainly patients should be able to go into the portal and request that, you know, the record and the information. But I don't know that that's necessarily a change from what they can request today, at least in some places and some implementations. I expect it's not.
All right. So any strong feelings on this that we need to make a recommendation?
The one thing, I guess, going slightly earlier, Denise, you and Les had called out the difference between the legal medical record and this proposal. I didn't capture a proposal on this. Are we proposing as a group that this should only apply to electronic health information that would be part of the legal medical record?
Yeah, I think that would be a good recommendation because, you know.
God, no, it should be limited that way.
Yeah, because it would address that issue of a note that's in progress that hasn't even been signed.
And it would address the issue of research information in an electronic health record, which should not be released. And it would, and
unless you're part of All of Us or whatever that project is, they're actually providing patients information from the research project.
Well, yeah, again, that's a different type of release, right? But if you accidentally release research-related results and they're disclosed inappropriately that are not part of the medical record, then that's a liability issue too.
Yeah,
for example, an HIV test that was performed as part of a research study.
And I agree with, I see why you're proposing that, and I agree it solves the problem of like a note in progress. From a technical perspective, it adds another layer of complexity to the export because the query has to differentiate. Again, it has to allow for some amount of editing and filtering for state law, but then also for organizational policy determining what would be part of their legal medical record.
And this is John, I think, you know, since it's a certification requirement, not a use requirement, its intent is to set up kind of an outer bounds on what's possible to accommodate those differences. So, you know, and it doesn't dictate to us necessarily a technical design, but I think its spirit is definitely that it's intended to be broad enough that the capability is there that can be configured and adapted to fit to those types of requirements. So I'd want to be a little careful about limiting, as much as I know what I said about scope of EHR, and data held by and all of that. I think they are trying to make it broad enough to deal with the vagaries of difference that's going to occur at the state and local level or at the organizational policy level.
Right, and no one EHR developer would be able to create one export query that would accommodate every possible state and local variance, every possible healthcare system definition of a legal medical record, any possible usage restrictions on data that might be in an EHR. So I think kind of implicit in the complexity of this proposal is that there will be a role for healthcare organizations to sort of define what they're putting into the export and then potentially, as Denise suggested, have a medical records role in reviewing that if it can't be automated, what should be in and should be out, and needs to happen through manual review.
Mm-hmm. No, and I know, like, Marshfield, they sent PDFs, electronic PDFs, and so they were able to review it, and it was useful format. As a patient, it's a useful format to then take to the next provider.
PDF wouldn't meet this requirement, though.
They mentioned PDF in here that they don't dictate the electronic format.
But it has to be computable.
It has to be processable.
In D, Denise?
Oh. Okay.
And so I'm picturing that it would be something, you know, like maybe a giant XML file. I mean, who knows? I guess that's left open to whatever the developer would decide was most suited, but...
Yeah, I can see that being a way, but that also gets back to some practical questions about the contemporary, I think an assumption made of a fairly contemporary level of technology and not some old 30-year-old COBOL-based.
Right.
Kind of contradicts what's on page 92 of the preamble where it mentions PDF.
I think it might be how it's provided
because, again, I think what we need to remember with certification, it's about capability, not prescribing use. And you know, that may be for a number of reasons. The patient may ask for it as a PDF. The patient may ask for it in a form that can't be provided, and that's the negotiated settlement. Those are all things that are possible, but as to the capability that needs to be present in a certified system, they are after it being something that can be processed that carries with it, you know, the structured reference meaning of what is being produced. So,
yeah, I read this reference to PDF, Denise, to say something like, if you have PDFs scanned into the database, those are also provided.
Yeah.
Not that you could convert to a PDF.
Got it. Okay, thank you for that clarification.
But I reread it,
and you're right.
Yeah, I do think that including PDFs, like other unstructured data, is challenging from a perspective of the filtering that we talked about earlier, right? If a patient's record has, you know, a bunch of different PDFs that are, you know, pathology results from some other system attached, the exact content of what's in the pathology result PDF is not sort of known to write a programmatic filter and will be a case that goes back to that manual review.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm watching our time because we do have some other things to get through. I want to make sure we cover some of the other comments that they're looking for here. They have a list of data that would not be included. And I know there's probably other data we've already said we don't think should be included based on how broad this is. But this is on page 95 and 96, and they were seeking comment on whether we also see comment for consideration in finalizing this criterion in a subsequent final rule on types of EHI that may present challenges for meeting the intent of this proposed criteria. Other than what they've listed metadata are things that would not be included. But is there anything else we want to add, or do you think we've covered our landscape in terms of our concerns on types of data?
Well, one thing that they asked about for comments, I think, was like audit trail data, which they said was not expected. If I recall correctly, audit logs are not expected in the export. They asked for comment on it. I mean, I think the challenge with that type of data, which might be in other parts of the EHI also, but is the privacy of all of the other parties who are working at the health system, for example. So something to think about if we decide to recommend audit logs be in.
Yeah, and actually, go ahead.
I was going to say that on the export for the database export, not the page single patient, I would think that the health system would need the audit logs included, particularly if there was any investigation done.
Oh, that's a good point. Maybe we would recommend it for the transitioning systems use case, but not the patient use case?
Yeah. Let's
I'll put
that
in as a proposal.
Okay.
I don't know that I noted anything else, and I know they don't get into this. The only other thing that comes to mind is, and I think the discretion is there, and maybe it's a comment of support or just a statement that assumes this and makes a supporting statement, but the provision of the semantic reference information is not a, much as the data might not be a singular concept because of the form by which it's stored or sourced, so is the provision of the reference information about it. I don't believe they get into stating that it needs to be singular in how you produce it, but I think it's
Doesn't
important
it
that it
have to be posted proactively on your website, though, John, which would imply to me that at least a superset or something is standard and available.
Yeah, it may be comprised of more than one reference. Like if you're going to post it through a wiki.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, depending on what products a particular system had licensed, I guess if it's not just the cert thing, but even in that case, the documentation practices and integrations would vary the data that's going to be in any given export.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there is a requirement to provide documentation about the export format. They do say you can protect your proprietary data model, depending on what your export format looks like. And then one other area of this that we do have to address is time frame. They are using the same two-year time frame. So on page 98, ONC seeks input on EHI export and timeframes, and particularly beyond exporting all of the EHI to the health IT system produces and electronically manages, should this criterion include capabilities to permit healthcare providers to set timeframes for an EHI export. So not for your development, but this is more for them to set timeframes.
Yeah, I guess my understanding was like if you wanted to say like, wow, your download's going to be super big, you know, it's going to be like 100 megabytes or whatever, would you prefer to just get your most recent year's worth of data and that's only 20 megabytes instead of the whole thing, something kind of along those lines? And I think it could be advantageous, and I assume this isn't prohibited. Health IT developers and providers might want to offer other options for patients, right? So you might want to say, like, hey, if you're really only interested in a certain type of data, or, you know, you don't care about the PDFs that are attached or whatever, and you can get it faster, either because it goes through manual review in the Health Information Management Department faster, or the query runs faster over a smaller data set, or the upload is faster because there's not as many images or whatever, I think that could be advantageous. And I can see why providers and health IT developers would offer it. I wouldn't offer time range-based filters. We know from the view, download, transmit criterion that time ranges are deceptively tricky that way, because if you pick a time range that doesn't really jive with the time ranges of medical activities, it's really complicated. Like if you say, give me the time range of data that, and one of the dates falls right in the middle of an admission, do you like parse the data from the admission to half be in and half be out? Like, how do you even distinguish that? Is it even what they really wanted? And so I think I would say don't require specific time ranges. We've learned from the view, download, transmit realm that that introduces more complexity maybe than was anticipated.
Well, why don't we make that as a recommendation here then?
Okay.
If everybody agrees not to have any specific set time frames because of the complications that had
have caused in the past.
Yeah, and as I recall, they did adopt kind of an intelligent response to that concern that you do have the ability to provide what is a whole contextual response. And so that may be the way to word it.
Now, what about the time frame for you all to have this developed and delivered?
The 2 years, and that, as I recall, includes rollout and adoption as well as development certification. Oh, boy. that's 2 years from the effective date of the final rule, so while that's effectively close to 3 years, it's still... it's a lot of work to roll out, and it. I don't know, Sasha. I feel like that they tried to listen to the old EHRA comment of 18 to 24 months from final rule to adoption as a minimum, and that they really, because this is repeated in a couple of other places on other topics about things we have to do. I can never recall a time when we've ever asked for more than that, but it's not going to be a trivial thing to get done and roll out. But
well, and ONC estimates that it would take between 160 and 1600 hours. John, I don't know about you, but here we've already spent probably close to 160 hours talking about design, and there's still a lot of effort left ahead to like actually further design and program it. So
and that doesn't
I think,
get into it all. Yeah, the effort of rolling it out, which is non-trivial.
Right.
Certainly a huge project. I guess there's both a development cost and an opportunity cost. So I think if it is rolled out over a relatively short time, like 2 years, which basically, you know, in my head gives like a year for development and a year for everyone to upgrade and implement it, then that will be the focus of health systems over the next couple of years. If we extend the time frame, it might allow for more diversity of focus over that time, but then, you know, the export feature isn't necessarily widely available until later.
Yeah.
And this update, by the way, is not happening in a vacuum either. It's going to be a major potential driver for adoption of new capability. I couldn't tell you yet if this necessitates what order of magnitude of update, you know, compared to other things. It, by itself, would it compel you to take an upgrade? That's a, you know, a pretty broad front thing. I don't know.
So don't have, I mean, as a committee, we don't have, you know, this might be better addressed by the public comment and the various vendors providing input on this.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have, unless you all have some strong, I'm sure you're all going to be making comments.
We probably have to be a little careful about being too vendor-centric in this forum, so to speak, for that. We'll make that, and you're right, it's not like we're not going to make a comment.
I'd encourage
or as an association that Josh and I are both a part of.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have about 21 minutes left. Can we go ahead and jump to is prescribing next? And actually, I read through that and I have no background to make any comments personally.
I have a few things that maybe I could start us off with, just kind of speaking to it. Let me not get much cooperation out of
I mean, fundamentally, it seems to make sense to align with what CMS is requiring in their program.
It does. I have, John, I guess some of my big picture is that aligning with CMS makes sense. Some of the transactions that ONC has proposed, they propose all of them are required for certification. That does not make sense because some of them are pharmacy-to-pharmacy transactions. Some of them are long-term care transactions. Some of them only are required if you have a certain architecture of your system, which many modern systems don't. And so we have to make a bunch of them optional.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would say. Scale back what's required to match to what is the current B3 and treat it as a replacement of the standard, and perhaps make the remainder optional. If somebody wants to seek them, great, but you said it very well, Sasha. That's exactly what we would say.
Yeah. I actually had a proposed edit here. I'll stick it in the notes. So if people want to scroll down.
Because I was going to say that, you know, various health IT products can get certification. So it's not just EHRs. And I think, you know, and then for like long-term care products and those kind of things, you know, I would think that for those products to come in and get certification, that, you know, then they would want to do these optional things. Otherwise, what would be the benefit of their product if they're not going to provide?
No, I agree. So what I tried to do with these edits, which are in red, was sort of say, instead of doing all of these, do whichever subset are relevant to the domain of the product. And some of them haven't been piloted or are new, so I also put in and are piloted and ready. And so then I went through each one. So like A, I think is only applicable in a certain architecture, so I said make that optional. D is new, and I think parts of it should be piloted prior to widespread adoption. So like new Rx I think is fine, but then new Rx request and new Rx response denied, I'd like to see pilots prior to adoption. And then like some of these like drug administration and K is a long-term care flow, so that would only be relevant if you are a long-term care product. Some of these are pharmacy flows, like pharmacy-to-pharmacy communication, which would only be applicable if you were a pharmacy product, and I don't know why a pharmacy product would be getting certified. And then the REMS things were new. I think those should be piloted before they're required for all products. And then in II, they say put the diagnosis segment in every transaction, but not every transaction listed above actually has a spot for a diagnosis segment, so I just added the if the segment is supported.
So generally the way we would write draft a recommendation on this, Kate, would be to say for these items we recommend they be optional because they're new and they haven't been tested or used, and then the ones that we recommend that be piloted. So Kate's going to help draft some of this up, Sasha.
Kate, do you want me to put my transaction by transaction notes into the Google Doc?
Yeah, that would be helpful. Thanks, Sasha.
Sure.
Okay. Other things on pharmacy?
That was the main reaction that we had.
And then the only other thing I thought about is that, you know, given the fact that this is going to require some development on the developer's part, these dates aren't necessarily going to coincide with the 24-month date. I don't know if that's an issue because CMS right now is targeting January of 2020.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. The recognition and retirement, I guess I didn't pick it up here because I was focused on that being more towards the retirement of the B3 criteria, which they've said, you know, they mean to coincide with the 2017-071 adoption. But they may want to, I think all we were really trying to say was to find some wording that, you know, don't be premature with the setting of the sunset date of that criteria in favor of the new e-prescribing criteria, because there still could be action taken. And I think they're open to that by the way that they speak of it.
Yeah.
My
don't
thinking,
do a hard
Denise,
setting of a date yet.
I think if they narrow the set of transactions to kind of the ones John and I are recommending, which is like the scope of what was previously in certification, just the new transaction standards, then it is reasonable to do by 2020. People have been kind of planning that based on CMS's regs. But if they add these other transactions in that don't make sense in context or still need to be piloted, then it jeopardizes CMS's plan to switch standards on 1/1/2020.
All right. Well, we should say that as part of our recommendation.
Let me put it in
a note.
That's
a good way to state it.
Okay. All right. Can we talk about the clinical quality measure change?
Yeah. There's others more expert, and I don't know that we've done the work to necessarily assess this, but there's a strangeness that's introduced by the adoption of the CMS standard for C3 as the exclusive basis of standard. One reaction is that they're not making any changes to the use of QRDA for C1 or C2. And I don't know, it's a little bit in the realm of, I'm not quite sure what that does, but that caught the attention of our quality team. And also, just to note, there's a difference in what the CMS specification covers, which, if I think correctly, that only impacted the CMS hospital electronic clinical quality measure reporting. And so that adoption for C3 might be a strange impact to the ambulatory reporting of clinical quality measures.
Yeah,
well,
I agree, John. And
they
actually
do.
I put a table into the notes way down at the bottom if you want to scroll. Sorry, Kate, for keeping you scroll. But I think this is what John is articulating, and I had this table, so I copied it in here. CMS is, or ONC is proposing that across all products, import use the inpatient CMS implementation guide, export for QRDA 1 use the inpatient CMS implementation guide, and QRDA 3 export use the ambulatory implementation guide. And I don't think that's going to work technically. If you scroll down, I made a new table of like what I think has to happen based on knowledge of the quality standard. There has to be differentiation based on the ambulatory setting and inpatient setting, because it does not make sense to use the implementation guide for the wrong setting.
That is it exactly.
All right. Well, we should probably consider this in our recommendations that this may be problematic and should be evaluated.
The other question I just had about this one was what the timing was. Like, when does this take effect?
Kate, do you know on this? Is this the 24 months or is this right away?
I will get back to you on that.
Okay. All right. So we're coming up on public comment. Is that correct, Lauren?
Yep, that's correct.
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. And then if we have a few minutes, we can talk about the two attestations that have to occur related to security. And also to implement that and cert. And if we don't have time to do that, then we'll add that to our agenda Monday.
Okay.
So if you want to go ahead with public comment.
Yeah, we may still have a few minutes. I don't see too many participants, but operator, can you please open the public line?
If you'd like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you'd like to move your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you. And do we have any comments in the queue at this time?
Not at this time.
Okay. I'll hand it back to you, Denise, for the last 10 minutes or so, if we wanted to wrap up on that last point on quality measures.
Yeah. So anything else on quality measures? I think thank you for doing those tables, Sasha, because that, and then if we could put a little context around that,
about what the dilemma will be if they proceed as proposed. Anything else?
Only other thought I had was they ask about migrating quality reporting to FHIR. ONC says they don't think FHIR is ready for that yet, but it's the future direction they'd like to move toward. I would wholeheartedly agree.
Oh, yes, on page 88.
It's a good future direction, but it's not there yet, so it's not ready.
So what? So we could just confirm that and say that we don't believe this is ready, but we endorse the future direction.
I'll add a note.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for doing these notes. You have been super helpful.
You're welcome. I
okay.
try to take good notes.
You do take good notes. All right, so the last area is around privacy and security transparency attestations. They're proposing two new 2015 edition transparency attestation certification criteria. One's for encrypt authentication credentials, and the other one is for multi-factor authentication. These also have a different timeline that I noted in here than the other timelines for meeting these attestations, I believe. Or at least I thought I noted that.
Yeah, it's 6 months.
Yep.
6 months.
I have a question about that.
Can you pull up, Kate, the actual regulatory text, what the regulatory text says?
Do you see it here?
Yeah, real time.
Encrypt authentication credentials.
Yeah. Must assess. Yeah, so each developer is going to assess their capabilities and make one of the following attestations, yes or no.
So I'll start off, I guess. Generally, I think encrypting authentication credentials and multi-factor authentication are both important practices, and assessing them in certification seems reasonable. Both of them have a degree of complexity that a yes-no answer doesn't necessarily get to. And so I think in both cases, it will be valuable to have like a description or a text box or something where the developer can explain like how do they support multi-factor authentication. The options might be different, whether it's the patient flow on the patient portal versus the provider who's accessing from home versus a provider in the clinic. Is it part of your product or a third party offering? Is it what level of the architecture is it at? And I think people want to describe that beyond like a yes and a no. The other, I guess, question I have is if this takes effect, I can see the value, as ONC puts it forward, of a yes-no attestation for future products that come onto the market. Because if a provider is making a purchasing decision, then they can look at this and say, like, oh, do I want to buy a product that supports multi-factor auth or doesn't, right? But if you think about the fact that this would be, in 6 months, applied to products that are already in widespread use, I'm wondering if it actually publicizes something that healthcare providers don't necessarily want publicized. If you're using a product, say an old version of a product that's out there, and then suddenly it's up on the internet that that product doesn't support multi-factor auth, for example, is that, I guess, making more widespread something, a vulnerability about the software that you're using? I'm wondering if it should only be applied to future products, I guess, to avoid unintended consequences for people who are already using things out in the wild, if that makes sense.
That does.
Yeah, hey, this here's a vulnerability. You're welcome to come exploit it.
If you don't provide this in your product and you have to say no, that's just going to hurt you with selling your product because it's going to be public.
Right, for new products that aren't already in use.
Yeah. But isn't the intent on this, and Kate can chime in, isn't the intent to actually get developers to modify their products so that they do support these?
capabilities?
Sure. We know in the preamble,
like,
or,
yeah, like,
and
isn't
in the impact
nudge.
Yeah, we included language in both the preamble and then the impact analysis.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the aim.
Yeah.
I think it's some to at least raise as a cautionary note. Does it rise strong enough, Sasha, to the level of saying this is a recommendation or keep in mind sort of comment?
I'm drafting, I guess, in our proposals that two of them, based on this privacy and security piece, one, don't just get a yes, no, but get like a description.
Yes.
And then two, I think apply the privacy and security attestations only to certifications that take place after this is finalized, not retrospectively to products that are already in use.
Yeah. I think that's
a good recommendation.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Wes and Carolyn, are you good with that?
I think so, yeah.
And these are draft recommendations. They're going to go before the whole committee to deliberate on.
I had one, and I don't know that this is not a big deal. It's something that just, I'm pretty sure the answer is no, but Sasha's comment about the different authentication pathways, kind of two things. So one, this goes towards your clarification, Sasha, and maybe it's something that we recommend that they do, but, you know, speak to all of your authentication capabilities, or at least speak to wherever you do this and in what context you do this, because for the very fact you may have multiple pathways in, they may not all be at par for two-factor or for encryption. So I think that's why the explanation is important. I know when we started talking about this, that came up. It's not not everything may be to the same level of ability, much less use of of the same method. The other thing is, does it strictly apply to, a login use case, or does it encompass other authentication use cases like signing electronic prescriptions for controlled substances, or, you know, where else you may be using two-factor authentication for electronic signature or digital signature. So I don't know if that's opening a can of worms, and if it's clear enough to you that that is in no way their intent, and that they are limiting it to the same scope as to what, you know, basically the access use case or the login use case would cover, that's fine. I just raise it.
I'm not sure what you're suggesting, John. Are you suggesting that
it's more of a point of clarity? Did anybody else read any other possibility than that this is strictly asking about user login types of use cases?
I thought it was asking about all use cases, which is part of why I suggest the text box for clarity, because you might have some methods of multi-factor auth that are applicable to login and some, but those might not qualify for EPCS standards by the DEA.
Right.
You might have DEA-supported standards that maybe are not the same as what a patient can use at home in the portal. And so the text, I guess the best answer I can come up with is have the developer describe it, because then you can elaborate on, like, this is how our software supports multi-factor auth, and a purchaser could look at that and understand it. I don't think there's a number of questions that can get at the required level of detail.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
well,
and I also
if
think
they,
it's
if
good
they do
to make...
Go,
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, if they do go with the recommendation to add a text box, that would even more strongly support the idea that these attestations don't go out there for already certified products, that they are on newly certified products.
Yes, good point.
Because that's going to reveal a whole lot of information.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it's good that the instruction for it is very clear that it is as to what its scope of applicability is. So to the point that it does include all authentication use cases, I think that that needs to be part of the instruction so that that's not misunderstood.
Okay. All right, so we're at the top of the hour, and I want to thank all of you, especially those of you who have slogged through all four meetings this week. I really appreciate it. And both on the task force and our ONC team, thank you. And so next week on Monday, we're going to talk about, is that on the slide, Kate, what we're covering next week?
Yes, it should be in the schedule of topics. Let me just see how I can get back to that. Excel, is there a way to get back to that? Or?
Yeah, we're there. So next week we're going to talk about modifications to the ONC Health IT Certification Program around corrections and principles of proper conduct for the certifying bodies and testing labs. So we are also going to have one other topic that's going to be added to that around talking about the four options related to the API standard, fire standard. And thank you for the information, John and Sasha, that you provided on that. And we'll discuss that on Monday.
Good.
All right. Well, I hope everybody has a nice weekend.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And then I'll call Owen's team. I'll call on the other line for our debrief.
Okay. Bye.